My parents discovered that I had perfect pitch when I annoyingly started correcting my mother from the other room when she would play anything, or naming notes from the other room, or whatever it is. And the fact that I had perfect pitch encouraged them to send me to lessons. I also would pick out tunes and things that I heard on the piano. So I definitely gravitated towards it. So they sent me to my first lesson when I was about 3 and a half or so.
So you yourself did pick out the piano as the instrument that you were very interested in.
Yes, absolutely. Although I don't know if there was a cello in the house, maybe I would have gravitated to that. But probably would have been more of a painful process for my parents.
And you made your orchestral debut when you were just 11 years old.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they tell me. I have very little memory of it, actually. Except I do remember what I played. I just don't remember how it went. I was very much interested in the piano, and I was very happy performing when I was a kid. I was very I just loved music and didn't have the concept of the stage being anything but comfortable.
Now, you have called Leon Flesher one of your most influential teachers. Tell us about some of the folks you studied with.
Yeah, Leon Flesher definitely was one of the most inspiring people in my life. He was in his 90s and has influenced generations of pianists, but he studied with Arthur Schnabel, who was one of the great pianists and teachers of a previous generation. He was the first person to record all the Beethoven sonatas, and just legendary. And he and Arthur Schnabel taught two of my teachers. One of them was in London, and the other one Maria Corcho, and the other one was Leon Flesher. And so that's kind of steeped in my psyche, a lot of this incredible insight and inspiration it's kind of hard to imagine, but Schnabel studied with somebody who studied with somebody who studied with Beethoven. So the one wonders how much kind of wisdom or what possibly came down the line there, you know? Beethoven to Liszt to Czerny to Liszt to Leszczycki to Schnabel. So it's kind of it seems so close, you can almost retouch it. So it's a very, very kind of inspiring thought. But these people were just great, great musicians and great thinkers that I was very lucky to be around.
Tell us about some of your recent awards. I know in 2009 you won the Avery Fisher Career Grant, and you've gone on to win more awards and done some pretty amazing things.
Awards are very, very nice, and it's nice to get recognition. For me, it was especially nice to be having moved to New York only in 2006, and before that I was in London, and being accepted and recognized in some way by Lincoln Center and by all these legendary places meant a lot to me, and was a real embrace from this country that I've never forgotten.
Now, last summer, you made your BBC Proms debut.
Yeah, that was an incredible festival. I was just there this year again a few weeks ago. That's as close as you get to being a gladiator in this profession. You go walk into this unbelievable hall, the Royal Albert Hall, thousands of people around you, in this gorgeous old hall and in the round, and they actually take out all the seats in the orchestra bit, in the main bit of the hall, and everybody kind of crams in and stands which is why they call it the Proms, the Promenades. And the atmosphere in that hall is something that's hard to describe, but it's one of the most exciting places you could play. It's definitely last year and this year have been major highlights for me, just in terms of playing to such, not only such a large amount of people, but also feeling the energy of these people really, really being into what you're doing, and just listening so intently and with such I guess for me, the quietness of an audience is the wave I surf on as a performer. It's the palpable energy of a room, and the more people there are, the more the quiet becomes, the bigger the wave in some way, you know, to surf on, and it's a thrilling experience.
Well, you've been doing a lot of surfing. You did a world premiere in Aspen, and you've done a debut with the Disney Concert Hall with Dudamel and the L.A. Phil and the San Francisco Symphony and Michael Tilson Thomas. You really have been playing with some amazing orchestras and in some amazing venues.
Yeah, I've been lucky, both in terms of who I've been playing with, and I've been lucky to really pursue things that I'm interested in. I'm very curious about a lot of different things, and I play a lot of different repertoire, and I like doing a lot of different things, and whether it's playing with all these great orchestras or doing different repertoire or playing chamber music or doing solo things or going outside the box. I've just started, I'm a music director of a summer festival in California now, so kind of coming at from the other angle, the curatorial angle. So I'm very lucky. It's one of those things that you can't quite believe it's a job, because you're really doing something you love doing every day.
And you must be really good at it on top of that. So tell us about this work you're going to be playing with the Des Moines Symphony. And you are quite fond of Beethoven, and now I understand why, because of this lineage. It's part of your DNA.
Oh, maybe, yeah. It's hard not to love Beethoven. I mean, I remember I was sitting around with a bunch of musician friends playing this very nerdy game this past summer, where if you had all these composers on a boat and, you know, you had to, the boat was sinking, you had to throw composers off because, you know, otherwise you had no choice. And who would you throw? And we went around, and as the game progressed, people threw more and more composers aboard, and the discussion became more and more heated. People really care about their composers. And I have to say, the last composer standing, the one that was left on the boat, was Beethoven. Nobody would dare throw him off. And it was, and I feel like a lot of people have the same feeling about Beethoven. He was just kind of such a seminal figure, and his music speaks so directly to us across generations. And for me, it's been part of my bread and butter forever. And I've just finished recording all the Beethoven concertos. And so for me, it's very special music, as it is for many people.
Give us a bit of history of what was happening when Beethoven was composing the Piano Concerto No. 5 in E-flat.
Title Emperor was not actually his. In fact, Beethoven didn't really name any of his pieces. All those names were given afterwards. But it's very apt for this very majestic piece. And we don't yet go into that period of Beethoven's life where he's struggling. Concertos are really public pieces, and this is very much his declaration to the world of, look what I can do, both as a performer and as a composer. I think very few people can not be moved by this piece, and especially that incredibly moving second movement. But the whole piece just is one of his most declamatory and majestic. It's definitely one of my favorites, as it is everybody else's. These pieces are popular for a reason.
Well, let's talk about the work and tell us what your favorite parts are, like with the Allegro movement.
How to pick a favorite in this piece? The second movement is the most moving, but the concerto opens with such an unusual kind of declaration of virtuosity. The orchestra basically is kind of like a magician's assistant at the beginning, you know, going ta-da, and then the piano starts this elaborate cadenza already, like this show-off of virtuosity and majesty. And throughout the piece, I feel like there's that kind of almost fight between the virtuosic and the lyrical, and the conversation that happens. Sometimes the piano is coaxing the orchestra to one side, and sometimes the orchestra does the same. And we think of a concerto as a virtuosic vehicle sometimes for the solo instrument. And while the previous concerto, the fourth concerto, was not like that to that extent, but the fifth is definitely a concerto with a capital C.
And the cadenzas, he wrote a little note, didn't he, in the score about how he wanted them, and he wanted them to use his cadenzas.
This is one of the only concertos that doesn't have an extent, because the norm at the time was that the soloist and the orchestra play, and then at a certain point, especially in the first movement, there's a moment where the orchestra stops, and the soloist goes on this extensive cadenza, which was normally improvised. In Mozart's time, and also in Beethoven's time. And Beethoven wrote out a lot of the cadenzas that he used in previous concertos. This concerto is a little bit unusual because there is no real cadenza. I mean, it sounds like you get to the point where there's a cadenza, and then the piano starts one, and then very quickly gets out of it and goes back to this surprising second theme, and so it's very unusual. I think that's why he didn't actually want anybody to play a cadenza. And the point was that it's truncated, and it's just, is there going to be a cadenza? But actually, no. So that's why I think he wanted that effect. He wanted it to be unusual. And music in general is about creating expectations and breaking those expectations. And that's what the entirety of, classical music, quote unquote, Western music, is based on that premise. And Beethoven was the master of creating and breaking those expectations. That's just one of the ways he did that.
Tell us about this brilliant second movement.
I think it's justly one of the most famous pieces of music and one of the most touching pieces of music. It's this hushed prayer, almost, this song. It's such a short movement, but it says so much about so much. I mean, that's one of the things I love about this music, is that you can find whatever you want in it. In the very basic level, it's just staggeringly beautiful. It's impossible almost not to get goosebumps when you hear this music. And he wrote something very beautiful in the piano entry. It's this word that I can't even translate, but it's just basically means veiled or hushed, but it means more than that. It's this expression that's innered, and that's what's so touching about this piece, because it feels like it's coming from the deepest place inside you. It touches you, but not trying to elicit emotion from it. Somebody once said that talking about music is like dancing about architecture. I'm not quite sure that that's true, but it's hard to talk about this movement. Everything about it is obvious when you're listening to it.
And then Beethoven, like in the first movement, does something unusual, connecting it to the third movement.
Yeah, we reach this point in the movement where there's just a stillness, and from that nothingness or that stillness comes a very dreamy mirroring of the theme from the last movement. You suddenly hear it as if it's coming from far, far, far away, and very slowly and very dreamily, and then you're not quite sure what's happening, and then he launches right into the third movement with very uncontained energy almost. It's not what was the norm then, is to kind of finish the movement and then go to the next movement. He connects them in an imaginative way, which he's done before in his piano sonatas. But this is really a magical moment. And it's always fun to play.
It's so joyful.
Yeah, from that soulful second movement, the romp of a last movement, it is full of joy and very contagious.
Well, and the piano, it has all these scales and these arpeggios. And it's just incredible. Yeah. You're all over the place.
Yeah, it gives you a workout. I've never need to do my exercises after I play that piece.
Is there anything you'd like to say about this concerto that you really want the audience to know, or a special spot for them to listen or anything?
I think a lot of great music exists in multiple levels. People always think, oh, you know, I don't know much about classical music, or I don't really know this piece. Or I think great music exists on lots of levels. Great music can be enjoyed in the level where you don't have to know anything about it. You can just listen to it, and it is just immediately gripping. The more you listen and the more you know about it, maybe the more you can appreciate why, and you can put words to why do you like it so much or don't like it. This piece very much wears its greatness on its sleeve. I mean, everything that you need to know about this piece is right there for the taking. There's nothing I can say that I think will make this experience less or more joyful. It's just a great, great piece of music that I can't wait to share with the audience.
So how many times have you performed The Emperor, and how do you keep it fresh and new for yourself?
Many, many, many times. And I've recorded it. And the question of how to keep things fresh is actually not very difficult for me. You know, great art with great music, it's endless. I mean, I find something new in it every time I play it, every time I practice it. I mean, the day that I stop finding this music interesting is the day I quit. But also, I always try and play it as if this is the premiere. And from performance to performance, you always try to think, okay, this is the first time it's being performed. People don't know what's coming next. Why is this so great? Why is this so surprising? Why is this so beautiful? I mean, just... and in every performance, there's going to be a person that... Or mostly, there's going to be a person that's never heard that piece before, and I'm playing for that person. The other thing is that every time I play this piece, I play it with a different orchestra, and I play it on a different piano. So it's a different piece every time. I mean, it reveals itself differently to me as well. I mean, it's... I can't replicate, even if I wanted to, what I did last time, because my colleagues are different, my instrument's different. And that certainly helps bring new things to light for the performer as well as for the audience, I think.